It's showtime.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, off and running for the final 3 days of the month of July 2019 and the beginning of August and the beginning of the end of summer. I'm Bob Kincaid, little ray of sunshine. Yeah, I'm sorry. I start grieving somewhere around the summer solstice as the days begin to grow shorter, and, well, I just can't help it. I'm seasonally affected, I suppose. But here it is, a brand new broadcast week. It is the 29th day of July, 2019. And we're off and running for more and Monday. As Brother Deacon Asa puts it, hot on both streams on board the Moran brain train. Hashtag Trump's burning loins. Oh, dear God, I don't even want to say it. Yeah. Hunk of burning flab. Oh, well, I'll try to get that image out of my head. Man, what a weekend. I got the griddle put together, seasoned it, got it all nice, started playing with it, learned some of its quirk and quirks and proclivities. I've got a batch of sourdough starter that's getting funkier by the day. I anticipate sourdough pancakes by next week, assuming, weather permitting. It was a great weekend. Sunshine all around. Got to play out in the yard. My attitude improves exponentially when I can be outside doing stuff like that. I found out that you can open a package of bacon, an entire package of bacon, get that griddle going, and by the time you have laid out the final slice of the package of bacon, it's time to turn the first one. And by the time you've turned the last one, it's time to take the first one off. You can literally do a package of bacon on that griddle faster than you can do it in the microwave. And it tastes immensely better, too. So there has been there's been two or three rounds of bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches. Tinkered with here and there, some cheese, some avocado. Ferg wanted a sunny side up egg on his and said it was the best thing he'd ever eaten in his life. It was just fun, and got some work done in the yard. Cleaned out the refrigerator, and just generally, to the extent humanly possible, relaxed and, in a way, I guess, denied reality and acted as if the nightmares because there was a nightmare going on all weekend. Yeah, there was. And we'll get to it, too. But this program, like every other program on the horn, begins with gratitude. Thanks to our subscribers. And that in particular means thanks to Smitty, and thanks to Sharon. Thanks to Philip, thanks to Randy, thanks to Charlene, thanks to Robert in Australia, thanks to Jules, and that closes out the PayPal subscriptions for the month of July. And so we will now run downhill to the beginning of August. Thank you. Thank you one and all to all of our subscribers all month long, every month, who knock out about a quarter of the fundraising needs that we need to keep this program going. Thank you so very, very much. And so with that having been said, we can sort of dive into the program. Like I said, I divorced myself briefly from reality and did my best to pretend that the horrors weren't unfolding, but they were. The President of the United States got about as close as he has gotten yet, and I still have a $5 bet out with a bookie that he will eventually use that word. It's almost statistically impossible that he doesn't use it privately almost constantly, but he'll screw it. Well, I guess the real bet is whether it'll be a screw-up or it'll be intentional. I mean, you're right there at using that word that's the same as, has all the same letters as ginger, but isn't. When you suggest that the people who live in a particular area aren't human beings. That's what he said about Elijah Cummings' district there in Baltimore, or Balmer, as some of its residents refer to it, or as our buddy Reverbo reminded me, Charm City. Among other things, Julius Geezer referred to Balmer as rat-infested, which is kind of funny when you consider that his own skeevy, scurvy, filthy, disgusting properties have been repeatedly cited at the critical level by health authorities for, you know, because goddess of irony, rat infestation. I mean, you can go to the grill at Trump Tower and order yourself a Mexican salad bowl without so much rat in it. Well, it's rather a lot, really. And probably get it. And then there's the fact that one of the major slumlords in the area is his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Jared Kushner, who has been repeatedly cited for, well, there you go again, rat infestations. Now, was Nitwit Nero saying that Elijah Cummings wasn't doing enough to deal with the rat infestations at Kushner properties? That presupposes a level of actual thought on the part of the orangutan that I don't think he's actually capable of. No, it was just a matter of lashing out because, well, last week, Elijah Cummings was given the power to issue subpoenas to Jared and Ivanka. We also saw a week in which, even though there was no rain involved, melanoma showed up at an event wearing a top that caused Agnes to declare, "What is wrong with that woman's kidneys?" There was nothing left to the imagination. And this, of course, also has an Ivanka tie-in because melanoma has to constantly compete against Ivanka for anything resembling the affections of Tangerine Tiberius. Yeah, I have a feeling it's going to be a rather busy little night here this Moran Monday. If you'd like to enhance the experience, run on by headon.live, click on chat room, pick yourself out a screen name and a password, and jump in and be immediately greeted by the likes of Anatole and James and Squeaky, and capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who although a third stage guild master has not folded space in quite some time to the man cave because it's rather hot, I take it. You'll also be moderated by pinch hit midweek chat room utility moderator and all around great guy Steve from Georgistan. It's going to be a grand conversation, I do believe. But there it was. A series of, by Sunday, something on the order of 15 tweets attacking one man. One man, Elijah Cummings, chairman of the House Oversight Committee. A man who rose up from being the son of a sharecropper to being one of the most powerful men in the Congress of the United States. That a black man would do that is, of course, infuriating to a white supremacist like Donald Trump. And make no mistake, Donald Trump is a white supremacist. The only thing that could have made the tweet storm that he put out over this weekend more racist would have been had he done so while wearing his daddy's Klan robes. And it's one thing to point out the fact that he's a racist. Over the weekend, I got to thinking about the impact of his racism. Once upon a time in this country, white supremacy was not just a fact or a fact of life in this country. It was the operating philosophy of this country. It was baked into the way we did our civic business. We've talked about this from time to time. And it is an ugly piece of history, a hateful piece of history, an agonizingly painful piece of history. But you do not pretend that it did not happen just because it is uncomfortable to consider. Once upon a time, when white supremacy was baked into the legal system of this country, it was no problem for a president to be a white supremacist. But things changed. One of the principal elements of the oath of office that the president takes is that he, up until now, it's been he, will faithfully execute the laws of the United States of America. Well, Supreme Court decisions have the force of law. For instance, Brown versus Board of Education. But so too do statutes themselves, passed by both houses of Congress and signed into law by the president. Things like, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, under which Donald Trump, in the case of the latter there, the Fair Housing Act, under which Donald Trump and his filthy old Klansman daddy were busted in the 1970s by none other than the Richard M. Nixon administration for violating. I've mentioned before how Trump would have stacks of rental applications, and he would mark some of them with the word C for colored, and they were not going to get an apartment. The government of we, the people of the United States, trying to form a more perfect union, found out about this and took legal action through the Justice Department against them. If you recall your Trumpian history, you know that this is when he first made the acquaintance of Roy Cohn. And instead of simply entering into a consent agreement, he wanted to see Roy Cohn lawyer up and be an asshole. And they paid Roy Cohn handsomely, and that's what Roy Cohn did. It was stupid to do it because all he had to do was say, okay, I won't do it anymore, sign the papers. Never would have even had to hire a lawyer. Because it's not like the Nixon administration, the Nixon DOJ. I mean, for Jesus' sakes, we're talking about John Mitchell here. Were firebrands correcting racial injustice. Just signed the paper. But no, they lawyered up, they fought their asses off, and then they got themselves beat. And they signed the consent agreement anyway. Given the nature of the personality of Donald Trump, it is not hard to imagine that that has stung him and burned at him every day since. Because he is, after all, nothing but a jiggling adipose wad of insecurities, fears, paranoias, and resentment. And greed. And so that comes down to the modern era, shaping him and forming him all the way. Central Park Five, as we have discussed. His demands, even after the young men were proven not to have been even remotely guilty of the crimes, that they be executed anyway. So at the risk of having you think that I have gone into some sort of long-form digression and I'm never going to loop back to the initial premise, ha-ha, no. As I said, once upon a time, white supremacy was baked into the laws of this country. And so if you were a white supremacist president, like, say, Herbert Hoover, or Calvin Coolidge, or Woodrow Wilson, or Warren Gamaliel Harding, and the list is much longer, being a white supremacist wasn't a challenge. But with the arrival of the great civil rights awakening and the great civil rights laws that were passed after an outpouring of entirely too much blood and sweat and tears, things changed. No longer could a president of the United States be an unabashed white supremacist. He had to at least not say it out loud. But with the rise of our acknowledgement in the form of laws passed that we were going to, in our effort to create a more perfect union, we were going to try to bring out some remove some of our racist past in hopes of making a better country. Yeah, there's a little data point. Flavio says, just saying, Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith, was the first film ever shown in the White House, in the East Room, on February 18th, 1915. Woodrow Wilson loved it. Woodrow Wilson, remember, was from Virginia, not New Jersey. He'd been president of Princeton University, but he was from Virginia. Oh, he loved it. Yes, he loved it because he was a white supremacist. And let us remember that what was called Birth of a Nation in film was made from a novel called The Klansman, in which The Klansman, the title character, was the hero. You think maggots know any of this stuff?
Well, I know Woodrow Wilson was a fucking Democrat. Robert Byrd. Narble Woosh Gorga.
Yeah. But, like I said, once the great pieces of civil rights legislation were passed, presidents could no longer be openly white supremacist. At the very least, they had to keep it under wraps. You know, until they said things on tape like, Well, Billy, we could make America great again if it weren't for the Jews. The Jews, Billy, the Jews. And Billy Graham sat there, yes, Mr. President, I agree with everything you say. You are anointed of God. Hopefully somewhere in hell Billy Graham's getting a reverse pineapple for that even as we speak. I mean, if there was a hell, there isn't. That's why certain punishments have to be meted out here on Earth. But to try to reach for the thesis that I wanted to open the program with, I've been thinking about this for several days. That's the way it works out with this program. Friday comes along, take a little breather, get up Saturday morning, and start piling up morans like cordwood before winter. And somewhere over the course of the weekend, a couple of ideas will take shape betwixt my ears, and we'll start talking about them on Monday. Well, this is that idea. And as I watched the tweet storm unfold over the weekend, these monumental manifestations of the most pernicious, vicious, sickening racism uttered by the President of the United States of America. V.T. Blum says, Bob, don't forget George Wallace. Jesus, I mean, if we start going through the list, I did George Wallace, Lester Maddox, Strom Thurmond. It occurred to me that Strom Thurmond was the one who inoculated the Republican Party with racism. Not against it, but with it. When he left the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party was moving toward slowly, toward an acknowledgement that Jim Crow and racism were wrong. Well, that was the moment when the virus entered the Republican system. Strom Thurmond, who, meanwhile, had been making babies with the help, or at least baby. The help not being, white like Strom. But see, y'all do this to me. We're going to make lists now. Otto says Jesse Helms. James Eastland. On and on. But the point being that once those laws, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, became law, it became what we would hope would be impossible for a person to enter the White House and be a white supremacist. Every now and then, one or two of them would out themselves. I think about the infamous interview between Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, I'm comfortably well off, I'm socially secure, and that thing on his head, and Rachel Maddow, in which he said that had it been up to him, had he been around in 1964, no, by Jesus, he would not have voted for the Civil Rights Act. Because libertarian principles of economics would take care of things like lunch counters. Because people who were racist would no longer be able to stay in business once everybody realized how awful racism was. I think that theory has been proven to be meretricious bullshit, has it not? But for the most part, I mean, except for like when Ronald Reagan opens his 1980 presidential campaign in the home of the Klan at the Neshoba County, Mississippi fairgrounds, not at all far from where three young people were murdered by the Klan and buried in an earthen dam. Yeah, except for moments like that. And, well, okay, so I may be having some trouble with my thesis. But the bottom line here is that if the president swears an oath to faithfully execute the laws of the United States of America. Then by definition, he cannot be a white supremacist and do so. Because to faithfully execute the laws of the United States of America places a presumption upon the said president that he must not ever consider himself, and since we're still dealing with the past, up into the present, it's still all hims, I mean, you know, pronoun trouble. He cannot presume himself to be better than tens of millions of citizens of this country solely on account of the color of his white, pink, or in the present instance, tangerine skin. And I tell you what, as an aside, I briefly watched him today in his 9/11 fund bill signing ceremony there in the Rose Garden. And tangerine skinned has never seemed more of an apropos reference point. The cameras took close-ups of him in the Washington, D.C. sun. And not only was he the color of a tangerine, his skin has that lumpy bumpiness now of a tangerine or a tangelo or maybe one of those really thick-skinned navel oranges that you pay a buck and a half, $2 a piece for, and it turns out there's something the size of a tangerine inside it and, you know, an inch and a half of skin. He didn't look good. But the bottom line to this whole discussion is that you can, I believe, if you study the history of impeachment, why it's in the Constitution, what the framers thought of it when they created the concept that, as we understand it in American jurisprudence, handed down via the English jurisprudence. Being a white supremacist can very easily be considered to be a high crime and misdemeanor, or misdemeanor. I prefer to think of being a racist as being a high crime. Being a white supremacist as a high crime. But the problem, as we continue to consider the issue of impeachment, is that you don't do it piecemeal. You don't run out and file one bill of impeachment, and then later on file two more, and then 17 2 months from now. But I think going forward, I hope going forward, that as we do ponder the eventual reality of impeachment, that we will take into account that he should probably be, no, let's take the probably part out of it, he absolutely should be impeached, among other things, for the racist, white supremacist that he is. It would be a clear sign that that sort of behavior is intolerable and, in fact, unbearable and unconstitutional in what George Washington referred to as the chief magistrate of the nation. So give that some thought. Let's discuss it perhaps later in the evening. And let's see what we think it would mean for that process itself. It would have a count in a bill of impeachment that said he stands impeached for being a white supremacist racist would absolutely inflame the maggots like hemorrhoids gone wild. They wouldn't be able to sit down for a month of Sundays. But being a racist is an impeachable offense. Being a white supremacist is an impeachable offense. Being bigoted against people of color is an impeachable offense. Would we have any problem saying that if a man stood up and railed against... He doesn't, and this is an attempt to create some sort of insulation for himself. You know, part of his attacks on Ilhan Omar, she said terrible things about the state of Israel and the United States. How un-American. Well, that was an attempt to put some space between him and his Jew-hating Nazi supporters. But if a president of the United States came out and invade against Jews the way that he has invaded against Muslims and against African Americans, we wouldn't have any problem saying that that man should not be president of the United States. And I doubt we'd be willing to sit around and wait for another election cycle. We would recognize the danger, the global danger that posed. So yes, being a racist is an impeachable offense. You know, because it's not the same thing as George Bush not liking broccoli. It's not a personal preference. Racism is something that is not merely skin deep and is not esoteric or aesthetic. It is something that informs every breath one takes once one has taken it in and made it part of one's being. I think it's worth discussing. Darlene in Connecticut says, rats seem to be the theme as Trump will ensure the rat infestation of the DNI with the nomination of John Ratcliffe, whom I mentioned last week even looks like a rat. So now we know Ratcliffe was auditioning for the job during the Mueller hearing. A rat's loyalty is always rewarded under this administration. True, so true. The goddess of irony was paying close attention to that one. Rats off a cliff? Rats off a... You know, the only way it could have been made more obvious was if his name was Rats Off a Sinking Ship. But yeah, he does have a sort of rodent look about him, and the same thing occurred to me. Last week was an audition. He'd heard a little something-something, and he knew, I think a lot of Republicans knew, that Dan Coats was on the way out. I've never been a particular fan of Dan Coats, but to hear it told, if we are to believe what we're told, well, Dan Coats was kind of a bulwark against the ongoing assaults against the intelligence community. And so he's bailing out. Now, here's a question, and it's another one of those that popped up. Do all of these people, for the most part, get the note that says, time for you to go, and then they bail out politely?
because they're worried about what? Yeah, when they've been in government service for a long, long time, they bail out because they're worried about their pension. I mean, he went after Andrew McCabe's pension, remember? And if you've been in government service for a long, long time, that pension matters. It's worth many thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. And so that's why they don't say, well, you know, here's why I'm out. I wonder about that. I wonder if Dan Coats will have anything to say to the House or Senate intelligence committees once he is a private citizen. But do please remember, back when he was in Congress, Dan Coats was, in fact, a loony. He could be counted on to say crazy-ass GOP ultra-right-wing talking points as if you had just dropped a nickel in and walked away. Richard Burr mumbled something, and for Richard Burr to do this, and remember, the Mueller report identifies Richard Burr as the mole in the Senate Intelligence Committee who fed confidential Senate Intelligence Committee information to the Trump White House. So it was a little surprising when he said that John Ratcliffe's nomination to be Director of National Intelligence was problematic. And from an objective standpoint, it absolutely is. He has no intelligence experience whatsoever. I mean, at best, he was a mayor of a town of 8,000 in Texas, and before that, he was a U.S. attorney, again, with practically no intel experience, no counterterrorism experience, at damned all. Now, will the rest of the maggots in the Senate sing hallelujah and simply confirm him? Odds are likely, if you consult the magic eight ball. Answer points toward yes. But once again, we get down to that interesting mathematics. For instance, just for fun, of late, Joe Manchin, my senior senator, ouch, Joe Manchin has declared how dismayed he has been by some of the votes that he cast in favor of Trump nominees. Will he blithely go along with the nomination of John Ratcliffe? Don't know. How about perpetually disappointed Susan Collins?
Susan Collins of Maine.
She tweeted out something over the weekend saying that
she always had the greatest respect for Dan Coats, and he was a good director of national intelligence.
She didn't say anything about the fact that Nitwit Nero has nominated someone with no experience and no qualification whatsoever to fill his shoes. But she's in terrible shape for re-election up in Maine. And after the way she put the shiv to every woman in Maine by voting in favor of Brett Kavanaugh, one wonders. So, Susan Collins. How about Lisa Murkowski? How about Cory Gardner in Colorado, who's running for his political life right now? I mean, if you can get four or five of those folks, and you can get Joe Manchin to vote like a damn Democrat for once in his life, you might come close to Moscow Mitch having to tell Trump it ain't going to fly. Lots of things to think about. And gosh, we haven't even gotten to the National Ruble Association's roulette wheel of death, have we? Checking the mailbag. Bill in PA says, with the present president, I shudder at the fact that Donald Trump will faithfully execute the laws of the United States. I have a feeling that he'll execute the Constitution in a way that he wanted to execute the Central Park Five. Yeah, I think someone, I hope someone at the National Archives is just checking every day to make sure the darn thing's still there. Ron and Raleigh, going back to Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson said of Birth of a Nation was history writ with lightning. Marmalade Mugabe called Elijah Cummings a racist. Do you think that Cheeto-colored imbecile understands the nature of racism? Elijah Cummings can't be a racist. It is impossible. It is structurally, physically, functionally impossible. No, he does not understand that. And of course, today he turned his ire toward Al Sharpton. That's a good one, too. Randy in PA says, can we start calling Trump the Oompa Loompa oligarch? I think we can and we should. Kyle, with a message earlier today in Kentucky Stan. I've come to the conclusion that we no longer pay attention to the words that the President of the United States speaks unless... and pay no attention to him except through policy decisions he makes. I heard someone mentioning this over the weekend, yeah. His rhetoric, send her back, Al Sharpton hates whites and cops, so forth, is targeted a very small fraction of people. In order to win this election, we as a party and our candidates almost have to ignore him and run on policy because he can't beat us on it. Do not run against Trump. He may not be intentionally distracting, but his tweets and words have that effect. It saddens me to see the office of the presidency be so destroyed and defiled. More on that in a minute, because I've got a moron nomination just sitting right here that sort of dovetails with what Kyle's, and I'm not suggesting Kyle's a moron, but it touches on the issues therein. Back to food porn. Elbert wants to know, where'd you get your sourdough starter? My internet connection is now directly connected to our house's internet connection, so I no longer disrupt the house's Wi-Fi internet signal. When Dope 45 sends evil tweets at you, you must be doing your job properly. I made the sourdough starter. It's not like you got to get it somewhere. It's basic natural chemistry. The air is full of wild yeasts. And there's a little buttermilk in there to add some lactobacillus. You can use plain yogurt, too, as long as it's live active cultures. It's easy. It's, like I said, getting a little funkier every day. Yum. Darlene in Connecticut. Yeah, wasn't Nunez also running classified info about Mueller's Russia investigation or to Trump? He certainly was. But Mueller made a point of mentioning Burr in that footnote. I can't remember. I confess I don't have the pagination memorized. Yeah, and Devin Nunez, for about a minute and a half, thought that he might be the next DNI. Somebody must have told the Oompa Loompa oligarch. There you go, Randy. That wasn't going to fly. Is So just a couple of ideas to ponder as we move into this more in Monday. And yeah, it is, you know, the racism is there to be had and to be seen anywhere you care to look. Story's a little bit older, but consider, for instance, Lieutenant Governor of North Carolina, a guy named Dan Forrest. He's thinking he might like to be the governor of North Carolina come 2020. And back about a month ago, he delivered a sermon. No, really, it wasn't a political speech. It was a sermon at a church called Cornerstone Church. And they had a Celebrate America service. And this was a filthy piece of work.
And yet no other nation, my friends, has ever survived the diversity and multiculturalism that America faces today because of a lack of assimilation and because of this division and because of this identity politics. No other nation has ever survived this. But no other nation has ever been founded upon the principles of Jesus Christ that begin with the redemption and reconciliation through the atoning blood of our Savior. We can overcome the odds because God goes before us to reconcile and to redeem. This is not a zero-sum game. We win and they lose. This is a win-win game. We win, they win, America wins, and the world wins.
Trying to figure out who the they are and how they win when Christian theocracy takes over. But there now, see, we're back to dog whistling now. Inveighing against multiculturalism is the Sunday go to meeting version of rice mixing. I can't have no rice mixing. And that argument about how no other nation has ever survived diversity and multiculturalism is unmitigated bullshit, but it's also part and parcel of white-wing ideology. Nazis say this shit all the time. Skinheads. Identity Europa. Those other goons and goobs. Because there are plenty of nations and countries and geographies where people have lived side by side in harmony. It ain't Wednesday or anything, but I'll point out that that was exactly the case in ancient Rome, where before the rise of the church, Julius Caesar likely grew up in what was called an insula, in an area of Rome called the Subura, from which we get the word suburbs, under the city, beneath the city. He grew up in an apartment complex that was diverse and multicultural. And lo and behold, by the time he was an adult, they were putting up statues to him, as they had to Pompey before him, referring to him as the common savior of mankind over in what was known as Asia, and which is known to us in the modern world as the Middle East. Long before there were statues of Jesus the Savior, there were statues of Pompey and Caesar the Savior. But this little piece of dog whistle politics, and I'm sure went over great at that freakathon, because, well, American white evangelicals embrace racism. Plain and simple. But that really wasn't where I was going. John Cornhole, who in more ways than one is number two in the Senate, well, John Cornhole, or one of his staffers, I like to think of him as the great Cornholio, sent out a tweet. He got pissy because Chuck Schumer said, "It's been 2 years in the Senate since we blocked Donald Trump from repealing our health care law and ending protections for Americans with pre-existing conditions. But they just keep trying to take away those protections anyway. Believe what they do, not what they say." As true as far as it goes. And it is a fact that when the case was heard, and we've talked about this in the past, when the case was heard in the 5th United States Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, the case of against the ACA brought in Texas and declared unconstitutional by a federal judge in Texas, hint, not an Obama or Clinton appointee. Well, a couple of the justices, judges on the appellate court sounded like they were all eager to declare it unconstitutional and send it on up to old Balls and Strikes Roberts and Clarence Pubes on the Coke Can Slappy Thomas, Sammy Bad Breath Alito, and Ann's boy Neil Gorsuch, and of course, Brat Kavanaugh, so that they could take away the health care of tens of millions of American citizens. This will be a problem for the Republicans, and that's why, subtweeting what Chuck Schumer sent out, John Cornholio said, "Again and again, Democrats have refused to join Republicans in guaranteeing coverage for pre-existing conditions." There's only one problem with his tweet. Republicans have never made so much as a fainting effort to protect coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. People like me and people like a whole bunch of other folks in the Horn Family Community Congregation and millions of Americans across the country. Oh, sure, at one point the Republicans put out something that kind of, sort of, maybe smelled a little like it might have some pre-existing condition protection in it. But when you looked closely at it, it turned out that it actually would allow the insurance companies to charge so much for pre-existing condition coverage as to render it inaccessible to the vast majority of American citizens, thereby being no pre-existing coverage protection whatsoever. But they're Republicans, and therefore they operate on the time-tested theory of the big lie. Don't tell little lies. Tell a great big whopper, and tell it again and again and again, and as long as you have a compliant media, eventually they will turn it into something that gets held out like a turd on a plate, stinking and fly-blown in the summer sun, as truth. And that's what John Cornhole was doing. Because they're going to need a big lie like this, and I have no doubt that this tweet was also sent in anticipation of what may very well happen if this thing goes up to the Supreme Court. John Roberts might just go along this time. Who knows? I mean, back right when the cases were filed right after the Affordable Care Act became law, well, John Cornhole and 36 other Repiglicans from the Senate filed an amicus brief with the Supreme Court of the United States demanding that they repeal the ACA entirely. Then later on, John Cornhole joined a bunch of Republican members of the House and Senate and asked the Supreme Court to take the insurance marketplaces out behind the barn and beat it to death with an axe handle. And this, of course, is on top of the 70 attempts that Republicans have made to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Again, with nothing whatsoever in the way of a replacement for it. But he's a Republican, so he can just lie. And I'm guessing if you watched the multimillionaire for-profit media at all today, you didn't see any coverage of that. I mean, it's just another dog bites man story. Where's the news in where's the news in a Republican trying to take away health care from tens of millions of American citizens? Shit, they do that every day. See how it works? Yeah. Like I said, we've scarcely touched on the horror yesterday in Gilroy, California. Before we go there, a note from Darlene, while we'll stay with national security for a moment. James Clapper was the first DNI to make the position effective. Even then, the DNI's real power comes from his ability to cajole and persuade the intel agencies to collaborate, cooperate, and coordinate. Much depends on the sitting president and how much he is on board with supporting an effective, strong DNI. So one coward, Ratcliffe, will most certainly do the other coward's, Trump's, bidding. Ratcliffe can do a great deal to hurt the effectiveness of the intel community and send it back to pre-9/11 decentralization, where one doesn't talk to the other, by simply doing nothing at all. Sounds like the perfect job for a Republican. He'll weaken the effectiveness of the intel community, which is exactly what Putin and his lackey grifter Trump want. This nomination by Trump and eventual confirmation by the Senate has serious repercussions for this country's national security. Moscow Mitch McConnell. Moscow Mitch McConnell and his ilk are playing with people's lives and this country's sovereignty and electoral franchise. But as Moscow Mitch said today, we're engaging in McCarthyism against him. Hilarious, huh? And yes, he really did say that. You get busted for doing Putin's bidding, and you holler McCarthyism about the people who have busted you. But the fact remains that last week alone, he killed two bills related to election security in the Senate on the claim that there was no Republican support for them. How about that? Wonder why there's no Republican support for them. Yeah, I know. Silly question. Well, hell, says Ron and Raleigh, going back to health care. Just because you can't pony up the cash doesn't mean you don't have access. You just can't afford it right now. Save up your aluminum can money. And you will at some point be able to afford coverage. See? Problem solved. Yeah, or at least, you know, make a down payment on a low-rent cremation. Pre-existing condition protections, GOP style. Steve in New York says, I remember this. They were called high-risk pools. I remember hearing something on NPR about it where the deductibles were routinely $10,000 and premiums prohibitively high with waiting periods of 6 months. You couldn't actually use the coverage for 6 months. Some catch that catch-22. It's the best there is. That coverage is no coverage at all. Yeah. Jesus. Oh, by the way, here, having reached the end of the first hour of this Morin Monday, thanks going out to Jim in Spain. Thank you, Jim, for jumping in. Much obliged. Much obliged indeed. Now, Gilroy, California. I guess it was about 9:30 last night when the news started filtering in. A young man with a gun, a very powerful gun, according to law enforcement sources, may have had help and cut through a security fence at the venue where the annual Gilroy Garlic Festival is held. Witnesses described the young man as being dressed almost like police. In other words, he was disguised. Because I'm sure there was a police presence at the festival. Never having met, you know, and I've actually got something in the kitchen years and years and years ago. A very dear friend of mine who lives not far from San Jose went to the Gilroy Garlic Festival and sent me one of those braided ropes of garlic. I don't know, maybe we used it up. Maybe there's some still left. But that was why I recognized the name, the word, the place, Gilroy, when I saw the news accounts. I have to assume it's a fun time. It was probably hot, sunny. Lots of people there. Lots of booths and carnival-style food to get and, you know, maybe some really nice stuff, too. Who knows? I always think of Bridge Day here when I think of these other festivals elsewhere. It's a sight to see here, Bridge Day. And if you've got anything even vaguely resembling acrophobia or claustrophobia, probably not a day to be, I mean, it's the only day you can walk out on the New River Gorge Bridge. But if you've got either, you don't want to. Just stay on the land side and enjoy the carnival food. But you have to pass through security to get on the bridge. I remember back in 2001, in the immediate aftermath of the attacks of September 11th, we didn't have Bridge Day because the people were absolutely certain that a 6-foot-tall Saudi guy with a portable dialysis machine was somewhere in a cave plotting his dastardly attack on a bridge in West Virginia. You know, because Islamofascism. Well, after that, they changed it. They changed it around a bit. It's only one side of the bridge now. and they instituted a lot of security, and you can't carry backpacks, and you damn sure can't carry guns, or you're not supposed to be able to, even though you can concealed carry anywhere in this state now, with a few notable exceptions. But it's a huge mass of people, and it's a big, giant party. It's the biggest one-day festival in West Virginia. And it's got to be a security nightmare. Hell, you could probably knock over every bank in Fayette County on Bridge Day, and cops wouldn't be able to respond. I mean, we bring out the federal FBI, federal police, the state police, the county sheriffs. They mobilize the National Guard for it. So that's my primary experience with big, really crowded festival sort of events. I imagine it was a little bit less densely packed at Gilroy. But the bottom line is, the murderer began shooting, had some sort of assault rifle type firearm. As the event was concluding, he opened fire. 12 people were injured, 3 people were killed. He did that in less than a minute because, according to Gilroy Police Chief Scott Smithy, the officers at the festival found him and engaged him in less than 60 seconds. He did that much damage, not in minutes, but in seconds. Randy in PA doesn't want me to give the killer's name. I don't know why. Six-year-old Stephen Romero went to the festival with his mama and his grandma. Both of them were injured in the shooting, too. Mama got shot in the hand. Grandma got shot in the leg. And little Stephen got shot into the grave. Somebody stuck a microphone in front of his father. And what a horrible thing that is to do. And he had nothing but his grief. He said, there's nothing I can really say besides try to be with him until I can put him in his resting spot, wherever that is. My son had his whole life to live, and he was only 6. That's all I can say. Darlene, Connecticut says, a damn garlic festival, just as we're about to enter county fair season. Now I'm worried about attending my town's local fair, one of the oldest continuing fairs in the state, at over a century old and considered world famous, attracting the likes of movie stars like Kevin Bacon and politicos like Senator Blumenthal et al. If that isn't also domestic terrorism, then I don't know what is. Of course it is. Of course it is. It's absolutely terrorism. It's the kind of domestic terrorism that the FBI director was talking about last week when he said more than half of the terrorism incidents that this country has faced in the last year or more have been right-wing domestic terrorism. Meanwhile, the National Ruble Association, through people like Dana Lush, well, said it's too soon. Too soon. And it's mean to implicate the NRA in this. You know, even though the National Ruble Association is part and parcel of why it's easier to buy an assault rifle in this country than it is to buy a fishing pole. And, of course, the 19-year-old who did this, I'm sure he had no problem whatsoever getting his hands on the weapon. Oh, and by the way, the county where Gilroy is a county in California where licensed concealed carry is quite legal. And so out the window goes the, if only there'd been a good guy with a gun there, this wouldn't have happened. Yeah, that scenario falls all to pieces when you consider that the good guy with a gun would only have been able legally to start shooting after the bad guy with the gun started in his own right. And given the fact that he was able to murder three and maim 12, the good guy with a gun really couldn't have done a damn thing. And might have made the situation manifestly worse, because then the cops would have had to deal with engaging two active shooters. And no, this isn't about mental health. This is about access to firearms and what it is, whatever it is in this country that makes murderers out of young men. I'd say young white men, but I can't necessarily, I mean, I've seen a picture of the guy, but he's got a name that doesn't necessarily fit with what we recognize as whatever passes for white. I'm sure at some point in the near future, if it hasn't happened already, the white wing will be out there screaming about that fact. Steve in New York writes, the latest spin of the NRA death wheel. When I heard this last night, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to think. Honestly, Bob, what's left to say? On the other hand, I think we should keep this in mind. If anyone tells us that we're politicizing this, rather than trying to say we aren't doing that, our response should be, you're goddamn right we're politicizing it. It's about time we do that to make sure something finally gets done. Because that argument's out there, too. Oh, well, you know, you can't stop this by making those guns illegal because people will just get them guns illegally. Make possession one of those things a capital offense felony. You might see people willing to possess those. But, you know, we don't want to do that because guns are sacred. Oh, and by the way, building on a response to one of Lady B's notes last week, you might notice that when I was talking about hillbillies and their guns, at no point did I say that, you need an AR-15 for groundhogs or deer or elk or Appalachian elephant. Buddy of mine said when he was growing up, they were, poaching is real. He said they were so poor when he was growing up that they referred to cattle as slow elk. Look at the horns on that one. But no, there's no real or legitimate reason for possessing one of these firearms. But of course, we've also been taught in cruel, hard, and bloody terms that you don't necessarily have to have one of those. Just a semi-automatic pistol with 15 or 17 rounds in it and a couple of clips ready to go. Magazines. I wouldn't want to give the NRA the gun people any butt hurt. You can still accomplish a lot. Nitwit Nero burbled something about it, and something about our fine law enforcement burble. 6-year-old little boy. Because Republicans don't value 6-year-old little boys as much as they do the Russian monies that have been funneled through the NRA for distribution to them. It really is that simple. Because we have a huge raft of Democratic presidential candidates, the Democrats ran out to immediately condemn what happened in Gilroy. Kamala Harris said, "Our country has a gun violence epidemic that we cannot tolerate." And yet, we do. Cory Booker, Beto O'Rourke both said something. Bernie said something. Bernie kind of had to say something, given his relationship with the NRA and the vote he cast for giving the NRA immunity from suit. You know, rural state senator. Same Appalachian Hills as West Virginia, just without any coal under him. Lucky them. Yeah, Julius Geezer said, "We express our deepest sadness and sorrow for the families who lost a previous loved one in the horrific shooting in Gilroy, California. We grieve for the families and ask that God comfort them." He said this at the outset to the Rose Garden ceremony about the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund reauthorization. In which he mistook the word 9/11 for non-elective. I kid you not. He also made a joke about the platform with the 9/11 families on it collapsing, and suggested that he was one of the first responders on 9/11.
Although I won't call myself a first responder, I was definitely down there. Well, he was.
He was down there, and he was on the phone giving a radio interview about how cool it was that now that the towers were down, he had the tallest building in Manhattan. Howdy doodles. But here's the reality by the numbers. We've had 22 incidents in this year, which is only 7 months old. 5 more months to go. 22 incidents where somebody's been shot or killed on a school campus. The latest mass murder was, of course, Virginia Beach only 2 months ago. And round and round she goes, and where the NRA's wheel stops, no one knows. But this is terrorism in its purest form. Because something like the Gilroy Garlic Festival, I mean, it was internationally known. And it had appropriate security. But a domestic terrorist with easy access to firearms in this country can turn any one of these things into a nightmare in mere minutes. But of course, the young man, yeah, I mean, he's white, okay? He's white. He's a white young man with an assault rifle. Well, being as how he's a 19-year-old, he's all plugged into social media. And it's going to be hard to describe him as anything but a right-wing domestic terrorist. Because just minutes before he opened fire, he put something on social media. In which he urged people to read a book. That book, not going to name it, was written in the 19th century and is a sort of a roadmap toward early manifestations of fascism. Did I say early 19th century? I meant late if I did. If you over in the filthy, fevered cesspits of places like 8chan, that book is frequently recommended alongside things like Mein Kampf. It's filled cover to cover with vitriolic anti-Semitism, sexism, white supremacy. It's got screeds against race mixing and is largely endorsive of eugenics. On his Instagram post, the young terrorist wrote, "Why overcrowd towns and pave more open space to make room for hordes of mestizos and Silicon Valley white twats?" So, of course, you get some misogyny in there, because of course. David in South Carolina, Stan writes, "Incel? 19-year-old white dude with right-wing fetish. He may have been incel, too." Yep. Sounds like it. And I think one of the things that we have to ponder is why these works appeal to a certain stratum of American, mostly white, male youth. Because it obviously motivates them from some sort of appeal to that dark corner of the human lizard brain where all the hate and fear lives. A 6-year-old boy, a 13-year-old little girl, and a guy in his 20s. Those are the three he murdered before he himself was killed. And they have to know they're going to be killed. They're not delusional. They're not crazy. I got to go back to that again, too. These are not crazy people. Had he lived, he would not have successfully mounted an insanity plea. Because he knew full well what he was doing, knew the wrongness of it, and did it anyway. That means something. When I was roughly the same age, I had friends who were positively transfixed by Ayn Rand. I finally got around to reading Atlas Shrugged, and I channeled my inner Truman Capote with every page I turned, and I said, "That's not writing, that's typing." It was horrible. But there were people who ate it with a spoon, and they were almost exclusively again, young, white males, who also had no appreciation whatsoever for the difference between good literature and bilious crap. Words in a row. And when I say it would be, we need to figure out why it is they are so easily made into murderers. Well, that's not the same as sending a small army of journalists out in the wake of November 2016 to get people in at the Busted Knuckle Dew Drop In and Coffee Cup Diner to explain to you about their economic anxiety. The other thing that will not be covered about this story, and this is just a reminder, is after things have died down, we're never going to be told the stories of the horrors of the people who survived and are now left holding tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical bills for which they will have no relief, none whatsoever. Witnesses to the shooting said he rose his gun up and just started spraying out rounds. Said he was ready to do some damage. He posted another piece about the Gilroy Festival and said, "Ah, garlic festival time. Come get wasted on overpriced shit." One witness said when he opened fire, he declared he was really angry. So, no answers except to note that there are going to be no answers because the country is in a state of ginned up, voter suppressed, voter oppressed fakery, so that especially in the Senate of the United States, tiny minorities of bigots and racists lord it over vast majority swaths of the United States, plain and simple. Halfway through the program, let's run over and check in with our buddy V.T. Blom. Hey, man.
Hey, Bob. Why are we allowing this to happen?
Help me, because there's allowing on multiple different levels, from the ground level to the philosophic to the political. And
okay,
and
they, one, and they, one and, sec, and, I got it. I've got a double.
Got an echo. And by the way, while VT Blom's sorting this out, Sparky reminds us he had to drive to Nevada to buy the gun. Assault weapons are illegal in California. And he bought bolt cutters to get through the fence. He was determined. He had a plan. Terrorists often do. Thanks, Sparky. But having to get things in other states is nothing new. You know, racist right-wingers love to say, well, look at Chicago. Well, the fact of the matter is, Chicago has meaningful gun laws on the books. But you can drive a half an hour to an hour into Wisconsin, and it's the Wild West. The same thing for Southern Illinois. And this is part of what happens when you've got a hodgepodge of little petty fiefdoms declaring what is and is not legal. Are you there, man?
I'm back.
Okay, good deal.
Sorry, I had my Bluetooth set on another channel, and so I had to bring it back. So Bob, why do we as sovereign citizens allow guns? When can we say enough is enough?
Well, the problem is that a majority of Americans have long said enough is enough. Even before Sandy Hook, we were saying enough is enough.
Sorry, I'm from Sandy Hook, and that was a really, really... That hurt.
Yeah,
That was deep.
Well,
I went to that school when I was an elementary student. That was my school.
Jesus.
And when that happened, I said, enough. And then they came out and said, oh, that's all fake.
Yeah.
And I said, it's not fake. I know these people.
And of course, one of the leading
Alex Jones.
Yeah, Alex Jones. And hopefully, eventually, there will be a court judgment entered against Alex Jones for every penny he has and every penny he will ever make.
Good. Can I have some of it?
Well,
he hurt me to my toes.
Yeah. But you're
I was a student there, and I know these people. That was my town. And then I got told, oh, I'm a bunch of liars.
Crisis actors. The word is, the phrase is crisis actors, Scott.
Oh, yes. That's right. Oh, well, we're really good at that.
But the question you ask is a serious one. And the thing is, why can't we stop it? The American people want to do something. There's no definitive one thing that the American people want to do, but we want to do something. We want to take affirmative steps toward making these, if not impossible and never again, then to drastically reduce the likelihood.
Well, can we get it down to below 2,000 people a year?
Ask the NRA, because they're the ones who give the permissions. I mean, you're in Florida. You know.
Yes, I am.
Florida has been the test lab for every rotten, insane, criminally masterminded gun law that the NRA has ever wanted. And I forget
Florida, we still haven't passed the concealed carry. It's not legal yet here.
You mean unlicensed concealed carry?
Right.
Yeah.
They still haven't passed that.
Yeah, we've got
that
here.
On it.
You never anywhere.
I've watched it. I'm watching it spread all over the country. And I'm going, damn, we started it here and they didn't pass it, and it's spread all over the country.
So you can carry a 30-round magazine in your pocket.
Yeah.
And go shoot up a school.
And in fact, if you read the literature, and I have, you'll find various reviews of various handguns. They're almost always semi-automatic, slim, small. And they use an interesting vocabulary, and they say things like, it won't print in your pocket, which makes it sound like it's some sort of goddamn Epson, and there's going to be ink. But what they mean is the outline of a loaded, ready-to-go firearm will not show in your pocket.
Right, when you're walking through the street.
Right.
And so you can then go out and kill 30 people.
Or at least,
or if you're not, if you're a bad shot, you'll get 15. You got 30 rounds.
But I mean, the bottom line to this, and you know, 2020 is a great time for people to stand up if they and you know, it is more complicated than it should be or needs to be.
Yes, it is.
But the fact of the matter is, 2020 would be a great time to begin to solve this problem. But the only way it gets solved is if you throw out every Republican on the ballot. Okay? If you make it political anathema for anyone to have ever taken one thin damn cent from the National Ruble Association.
But the problem is every single person in Congress has taken money from the NRA.
Not everyone, no.
Well, but it's
Every Republican? Every Republican? Yes.
Every Republican, yes.
And some Democrats?
Democrats.
Yes. I mean, for instance, there's a Democratic issue. This person is not getting any real traction, but there's a Democratic presidential candidate who gladly cashed NRA checks.
That was Kamala there.
No, that's Kirsten Gillibrand.
Oh, she's the one. Oh, that's right. She's the one who slept with guns under her bed.
Right.
You know, I couldn't, I have guns. I like guns. I don't mind guns. I shoot. I'm not a hunter, but I shoot. I like going out shooting once in a while. But my guns are in one closet. My ammunition is in another closet.
And you don't fall asleep every night waiting for the ISIS MS-13 Antifa to come blowing through your door, do you?
I don't think they exist.
No. Oh, and by the way, this happened in Gilroy. There was another thing that happened yesterday, too.
Uh-oh.
Shots fired outside a Miami synagogue.
That's my towns here. That's my Florida.
In an event that is being examined or investigated.
As a
hate crime.
Right. Damn, I haven't even seen that one. I haven't watched the news yet today.
Let me see. You might even know where this place is. Hold on a minute. I'm digging it up now. I saw this right after I saw the Gilroy news. Okay. North Miami.
Yep.
Man hit in leg. North Miami Beach Synagogue, a shooter fired six times from a car driven past Young Israel of North Miami Beach on Sunday, hitting an Orthodox Jewish man who was sitting outside.
The one you want to talk to would be Nicole.
Oh, I'm sure Nicole would know plenty about it, yeah.
Right, that's her, Coral Gables, that's her beat, that's where she lives, and it's like when the shooting happened in the school down there, that's her neighborhood. She went crazy.
But I mean, there are real world solutions that are possible. I get a little tired of seeing that phrase. I mean, it's real, but it's been beaten around so many times that it's lost.
What's that?
That it's lost anything like meaning. Kind of like neoliberal did, and a few other phrases. Socialism's one of them.
Neoliberal got turned into an attack phrase.
Well, neoliberal is anything that a progressive doesn't like. It has a real meaning, but and I discussed this on the program before, but it's been turned into you brought me a cold cup of coffee, or you know my fries were soggy. Neoliberal, but
not enough salt on my fries. Yeah,
common sense gun reform.
No.
The phrase means things, and it means things that make sense, but it's too prone to being turned into, you know, soggy French fries.
I've got common sense gun reform. Oh, let's make sure that everybody that has a gun knows how to shoot. That's common sense.
Yeah, well, I'm a little worried about that, though, because apparently we have lots of people who already know how to shoot, and they prove their effectiveness with every one of these things.
Right.
Knowing
how to shoot is not a prerequisite of owning a gun.
No.
You can definitely shoot without having any training. Welcome to the military.
Well, right, and that's what I was getting at. I mean, I had to pass a hunter safety course years and years and years ago when I wanted to go.
So did I.
Go stomping around in the woods looking for Bambi. Fortunately, I was no good. I was no good at it, and I think I was subconsciously repulsed by the idea of having to take Bambi apart sooner or later.
I did the same thing, and then I shot a partridge, and I was so upset that I killed this magnificent bird. I brought it home. And I said, okay, well, I don't know what to do with it. And I brought it to I brought it to a taxidermy place, and I said, what can we do with this? He said, you shot it up. It's dead.
Yeah.
And it's dead.
It's
and
in
I said,
pieces,
okay.
Right, yeah.
But I was upset, and I said, nope, I'm not hunting anymore. So I started hunting with, I started fishing, and I used barbless hooks, and I released everything I caught. And then I started hunting with my camera. And that's how I went hunting. And I caught wildlife in their natural habitat, being natural wildlife.
And now lo and behold, it involved almost every bit as much skill as shooting at things.
Shooting, it actually involves more skill. You really have to be good to get a camera shot of a deer. It's really hard to do. I've never done it. But now I'm starting in Florida. I'm going for manatee.
Oh, going underwater?
I'm going underwater.
Wow, that'll be cool.
I want manatee, and I want gators.
Scott, can we talk? No gators. I mean, did you not hear the story last week about the Alabama meth gators, for Christ's sake?
Yeah, I heard it. I heard about it. It's like, but they're in Alabama. I'm in Florida.
Well, if they're on meth in Alabama, what the fuck do you think they're on in Florida, dude?
Man, we got better drugs here.
Right. I don't think they're mellowed out eating, like, you know, possum weed brownies.
But no, I just bought a kayak. I've got a wetsuit. And I'm going out in the river.
Oh,
and
man, that'll be cool.
I'm going to go out and float around all day and look for gators and manatees. And all the rest of the wildlife. I mean, you live down here, I get all kinds of birds that you don't see anywhere else in the country.
Oh, no, the parts of Florida that they haven't paved or built a subdivision on yet can yield some real stunning natural beauty.
That's what I've got. I have one little tiny part still left here, and they're trying to pave it.
Well, of course, there's a dollar to be had out of it.
And we are fighting the hell to stop it.
have you ever read the Travis McGee series? I mentioned that the other night.
No, I didn't.
I don't know if you go in for reading, you know, classic detective fiction or anything, but that's a series worth going through.
Was he based in Florida?
Yeah, well, I mean, John D. McDonald wrote it, and the Travis, yeah, and what makes it special is the fact that, you know, going back as early as the early 1960s, you know, sort of walking in the footsteps of and alongside the woman who, the school there in Parkland.
Right.
Was named after her. She was the woman who sparked the environmental movement in Florida.
And you're missing her name as much as I am right now.
Marjorie Stoneman Douglas.
Thank you. Very good.
John D. McDonald was a resident of Florida too, and he saw what was happening, and so he puts observation about the wholesale destruction of Florida into the mouth of his hero, Travis McGee. And so you can read the series, and like I said, it goes from 1964 up to the early 80s. They're great little, I mean, okay, everything that's written, period, has its flaws. So
right.
in the case of John D. McDonald, God, it's kind of gross the way
he's a prisoner of the time.
Right. He's very studly. He's very 1964. I read Playboy studly. You know what I mean?
Yes. Name dropping
of early 1960s hi-fi equipment and shit like that. And
yep.
His approach to women is not the best by a long shot. But
I grew up in the same time as you did.
But the references to the environmental changes in Florida are kind of eye-opening to see happen in real time as he's writing the novels, is what I was getting
at. And that's the problem, is that hasn't stopped.
No, it went on steroids.
They're putting up some kind of a Walmart superstructure down in South Florida here that they are paving like 700 or 800 acres of the Everglades.
Yeah. Eventually the Everglades will be concrete.
That's it. That's what they're working on.
Sure. And because as you've noted in the past,
you can't make any money on the swamp.
Right. And those Seminoles are just in the way. They can sell shit by the side of a road as well as they can make it and sell it in Walmart.
We'll give them a booth.
Yeah. But you
go into Walmart, you get the little bank, you know, booth and the little eyeglass booth and the little, we've got the Seminole booth over here. What are they selling?
Right. But to get back to your original question, I mean, there are real things we can do. You know, we've been talking about closing the gun show loophole for ages. Make it illegal to sell a firearm without it being a straight-up, full ATF form fill-out transaction. As I've said before, here in a place like West Virginia and most of rural America, guns are more liquid than, from an economic standpoint, guns are more liquid than gold.
More liquid than drugs.
Pretty much. But if you know if you've got a bunch of guns and you've got to pay a bill, you can sell a nice shotgun and get pretty close to fair market value for it. So that needs to end. The bottom
was the gun conduit.
Sure.
To the rest of the eastern coast.
And you know, cracking down on sales across state lines when one of the dearest things to the NRA is to eliminate state lines for gun transfers and gun transport.
And gun laws.
I mean, as I've said, one of the simplest ways to go about this is simply requiring every gun owner to carry insurance, liability insurance, just like you have to have on a car.
Right.
But you would set the levels at an amount commensurate with the average treatment of, say, a gut wound.
Well, let the insurance companies set the level. They're
right.
very good at that.
Yeah, they are. They've got a lot of experience at it. You know, they would never insure against an intentional act, but simply making people carry accidental discharge liability insurance would go a long way, because the damage, whether it's intentional or accidental, the damage can be identical.
Right. When you lose a child because his brother
and then the gun goobers have to start answering questions. Do I want to pay a premium for $1 million coverage just because I've got a paranoid Confederate flag waving fantasy of standing off the government someday when the black helicopters come?
And no, it's the ISIS.
Well, the ISIS MS-13 black helicopters flown by Antifa, yeah.
Yeah, well, Antifa's flying it?
Oh, yeah, oh, fuck yeah. Sharia, okay. Sharia Antifa.
Oh, damn. Not them.
Oh, them, okay. them. But I gotta think the monthly premium for $1 million policy is going to be kind of steep.
I hope.
Yeah.
And that's what they don't want to happen.
Oh, no, no. They would say that was an impermissible infringement on the right to keep and bear arms. But the problem is, even Scalia's opinion, Fat Dead Tony's, in Heller, says that it is not an absolute right, the Second Amendment right, and that government can impose restrictions upon it.
But they will not let that happen.
I mean, if I don't have, I don't have any car accidents in 20 years. All right, but I still have to pay for auto insurance every month at a rate that I think is expensive and unfair.
Well, it's because of your age.
Partly, but God, it's even higher if you're young. If you're a younger male. You know, it goes after 25. It goes down a little bit for women, but it doesn't go down for guys for a while, and it never goes down
at
all.
You got to hit 60 before it goes down, and then don't have an accident.
Right, but the point is,
I had an accident when I was 62, and my insurance doubled.
Right, and so
it's going to be that guy for the rest of my life.
So I think a regulatory, administrative approach could take a lot of guns out of a lot of dumbasses' hands. And by the way, we've gotten a couple of notes along the way in this conversation. It's not an uh-oh. These are just brilliant observations. Lady B says, dude, Dylan Roof walked away with his life. You know, Dylan Roof got taken. He got taken to Burger King by the cops.
On his way to jail.
Yeah. Some white folks take delight in that fact. Timothy McVeigh got through a traffic stop. Jeffrey Dahmer's last victim was given back to him after he tried to escape. Is there a chance cops would take them out? Absolutely. But is there a chance they can be taken into custody unharmed? And that's how upside down America is. David in South Carolina, Stan, says, ironic that authoritarian regimes eventually come for people's guns. Vlad keeps tight controls on guns, though he did send lots of money to the NRA. And remember, part of that scam was that they were going to set up an NRA in the Russian Federation.
No.
It never ends. Jack in Shreveport, NRA money idea. Similar to the no new taxes pledge legislators signed, Grover Norquist, I think. How about a no new NRA money pledge? Start a pledge for politicians to sign which states the signer will never take NRA or their proxies money ever again. I guess some kind of deadline date would be necessary. That seems like a fine damned idea.
2024.
Now. But
not gonna happen now.
Kyle points out the U.S. has more guns per capita than any other nation. Hell, we have more guns than people. We've got enough to start giving the cattle guns too.
We have more guns than the rest of the world.
The U.S. has more gun deaths than any other nation. Simple logic and math tell you that it's obviously the video games and the music and mental health.
Oh, no, the video games now are really, really popular because some 16-year-old won $13 million playing...
Fortnite. Yeah.
And it's, so now it's, oh, your kid sitting in the basement playing video games 8 hours a day? Ooh, he's going to make you millions of dollars.
And the next thing you know, the Air Force is knocking on his door saying, hey, would you like to sit in a base outside Las Vegas and shoot Afghan wedding parties with Hellfire missiles? Would you like to do that, son? We think you'd be good at it. But Kyle asks, seriously, when the fuck is enough enough? Do they want everyone to be lying in the streets fucking dead to fulfill their prophecy? Is that what this cash grab for death is about? Jesus. Well, it might be him.
It might be. These kids, you know, it's like, I have a 23-year-old son. All he does is play video games. That's all he does. He sits at his computer or his... He's got a PlayStation and a whatever. He's got two different video game systems and a computer. That's what he does.
Yeah. And this...
When he's not working, he's playing video games. So I'm going to have to call him and say, okay, can you make me $3 million?
Yeah, how good are you, kid?
You've been doing this since you were 12. You've got to be good at it.
Well, you know, I remember the funny thing is once upon a time, and, you know, kids who are 12, 15, 17, 20 look at you like, what? I explained to them that we had to go into little video parlors with pockets and pockets full of quarters.
That's it.
You paid quarters to play video games? Yeah, yeah. But I can remember being stoned with my buddies back then saying, you know, this shit's all tied into the CIA and the FBI and the military. And they're just
those games are,
right. And they're connected. Because, you know, it's not like they just want to know who's really good at this stuff. And they're going to recruit you and you're going to wind up fighting wars remotely. And then lo and behold, drones.
Thank you.
I've been out in front of the curve for a long time. But, you know, you talked about being, you know, Sandy Hook being your school, your community. Well, I had a note from Cynthia. And Cynthia says, hey, Bob, a neighbor of mine, two houses down from me, worked a food booth at the Gilroy Garlic Festival yesterday.
Oh.
She left to go home 10 minutes before the shooting. I hate to think what might have happened to her if she hadn't done that. And a ranger friend of mine was also working a food booth, volunteering there with his wife and son for his son's high school band. They left about an hour before the shooting and could have been in the line of fire, too. He's going through a terrible mix of emotions today. I'm about to go meet him for coffee. I'm sure he'll have a lot to say, and I intend to give him a big hug.
That's a hug. That's a hug and a half.
Cynthia says, I think he's going to need it.
You know,
and the fact of the matter, yeah, both of those people.
When the Sandy Hook thing happened, I spent a day in serious, deep depression. That hurt so much, and I had to. I had people, and they all came around and said, "Oh, whoa, that's right. You're from there, aren't you?" So it's I said, don't talk to me. It hurt because they couldn't understand what I was going through. That hurt. That was my hometown. That's where my kids were born. That's where I grew up. And I could not handle the that's so sad. No, it's not so sad. This guy was, you could have stopped him. And then Alex Jones came out.
Yeah. And the thing is, he was a piece of work. And he was, And he, not Alex Jones, the shooter, he was made, he was made to be what he was by by his weirdo hoarder mother, and that's why he shot her first.
Right. She was dead from the go. And then, whatever. But then you had Alex Jones came out and said, oh, this didn't happen.
Yeah. And so for Cynthia talking to her neighbors, yeah, they're going to go through things. There is such a thing as survivor's guilt. And counseling would probably be appropriate. Because, you know, just waiting around for the PTSD to set in is not a good strategy.
So how do I survive this?
Well, I'm no expert or shrink, and I don't play one on the radio, but I think you can probably acknowledge that you've probably got a dose of it at a distance too.
I've got a PTSD.
Yeah, everybody in Parkland. You know, there's
in Sandy Hook.
I saw
we're all going through it.
Yeah, I saw a certain degree of, I guess, macabre satisfaction. Our buddy Haley in Arkansas sent me a story over the weekend. One of the boys who shot up a high school in Arkansas years ago died in a car wreck the other night.
Oh, man. People aren't celebrating, are they?
Well, I don't think they're celebrating, but I think they're maybe wandering around muttering karma.
Oh, God. That hurts.
And of course, he was a kid, and he was a white kid. So, he might have done some juvie time, might have even done a little grown-up time. But he got out, and of course, Arkansas did not send him to the chair for it, or the horizontal crucifix, as the case may be.
That's it. When you do the injections, great.
Yeah.
But he didn't deserve to die. Necessarily. That hurts.
Yeah, that was just it. No. Life on Earth.
Sometimes we live, and sometimes we die.
It's that whole trick of not making the dying unnecessarily early.
I want to live to 90.
I mean, the larger question, Scott, and I'm glad you've opened some of these doors. Why is it, and I'm not suggesting an outcome, what is it about the right-wing mindscape that makes this a viable alternative?
That's why I listen to you. That's why I listen to you, because I have no idea.
I've got a pretty good cross-section of, over the course of 15 years, a pretty good cross-section of people writing in, frustrated, angry, over any number of issues. But I can say with almost 100% certainty that the answers proposed are never, we need to start shooting people.
Nope. And I have,
so
I
what
have
what
the
is
same
it about
problem with you? I listen to you, and I say, okay, there are no answers. And you keep talking, and I listen and think, okay, that makes sense. But it doesn't make sense in the real world.
No, some of it, and it's not that there aren't any answers, Scott. It's that we haven't found them.
No, we're trying.
Central to this is why does the right-wing mindset default to, I need to kill some people, especially among young, white, authoritarian, right-wing males.
And then we go with the Nazis.
Well, but the thing is, that's not two separate lines of inquiry. Those are lines of inquiry that dovetail and converge.
Right.
Because I'm talking about sixth grade, seventh grade. the right wing, the neo-Nazis and white nationalists and white supremacists, whatever we're calling them this week, that's where they're recruiting. Do you remember the story a few months back about the little girl who got called down and sent home from school because she screamed at her classmates walking around giving the Hitler salute in Middle Tennessee? That might have been when you were out for a little bit, but when you get them at 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, that shit takes root for some reason. And it's the why it takes root is the part where the science and the medicine needs to come in. I don't mean as in dose them. I mean figure out scientifically and medically what it is about the adolescent male brain that, I mean, is it because their system is being flooded with testosterone? I don't know the answer. But it's clear from a data standpoint that there's something in the right-wing male mindset that defaults to murdering people. And if it was video games, then there would be right-wing young females murdering people if they played video games. These things don't make sense.
But they don't.
Right. It's
the women don't do it.
Maybe it is chemical. Maybe it is. I don't know.
It's testosterone.
Well, that seems just a shade too easy.
Well,
because then the answer becomes terrifyingly obvious.
So we kill the men.
No. Just, you know, little snip snip and, you know, everybody's going to be happy. I mean, the incels, okay? The involuntary celibates.
Those are the ones that drive me nuts. It's like, incel, why are you incel? Because you're an asshole.
Right, but they're incapable of engaging in that level of introspection. You know, there's something, you know,
I've known them all my life. I've known all these guys that can't get a date. I've never had that problem. I was married, and then when I wasn't married, I had many different girls. I did not have a problem dating. These guys have a problem dating. They can't get a date. Oh, So
instead of doing the hard work, relatively speaking, of figuring out, you know, why are you an asshole? Why am I not? It's easier to say, well, it's the women's fault, so I need to. But then we're back to the same goddamn problem again, Scott. Oh, so they go,
there
okay,
go.
It's the women's fault, and then they default to, so I need to shoot them. It's that I need to shoot them default position. That is the booger
position.
In all of this.
That's the NRA position.
Well, I mean, to be okay, I'm trying to be fair here. The NRA has never suggested shoot your girlfriend. I mean, they oppose domestic violence legislation. They oppose taking guns away from people charged with domestic violence. But they don't say, and to the best that I can tell, they don't even dog whistle, we need to be shooting women.
They don't oppose shooting women.
Well, what they do is they propose and they promote the idea of the firearm as a remedy. They let the dysfunction take its natural course.
And there's a safety on every gun.
Of, well, sorta, kinda.
There is.
Well, I mean, the safety.
Every gun I've ever owned, I'm 60 years old.
Yeah, if there's not a round in a chamber, it will not fire.
Right. There's a safety on every gun.
The problem is, the more modern firing mechanisms, and like Glocks, okay? The safety on a Glock is this little thing that depresses before you pull the trigger the rest of the way. And for instance, the New York, the NYPD had, I remember being told about this by some cop friends back in the 90s, when the NYPD gave up their wheel guns and started carrying Glocks, NYPD officers shot themselves fairly routinely because they'd go to they'd go to pull it out and their finger would be on that little mini thing and so bang, you know, on the way out of the holster.
And that's what's on the street.
And so a lot of small semi-automatic pistols, the ones that are meant that, you know, won't print in your pocket and that silly shit.
Right.
Well, the reason they don't print is because they don't have stuff sticking out from the side rails.
And can carry 30 rounds.
Well, the little tiny pocket pistols are more like 6 and 7.
What's the Mac?
You can't drop that in a jacket pocket or a pants pocket.
I wear one of those U-pocket, what's it called, the jackets?
Yeah, like the Carhartts?
I have pockets in there that'll carry a Glock.
Yeah.
I'm good at it.
Yeah, but the thing is, if you've got two or three extra magazines, you know, you don't, whatever. You know.
Oh, no, I've got six more pockets.
Right, and so this guy, this guy in Gilroy, was apparently dressed wearing, and there it's referred to as tactical clothing.
They got tactical clothing.
Yeah, they got blousy pockets all over them.
That's it.
And so you know he was ready to go, but we still haven't answered the essential question. And it's not.
Why do we stop this?
Yeah, it's not the same question as, you know, not to get all prayer meeting Wednesday or anything, but you know according to the Old Testament, the first murder is when Cain slays Abel.
Abel was dead.
And it happens because Cain becomes jealous of Abel's, the fact that God is fonder of Abel. There's all kinds of layers of actual mythic meaning for human society in there. It's about the difference between hunting and gathering versus agrarian society. But at the end of the day, Cain gets pissed off and picks up a rock and bashes in Abel's skull.
Right, so agrarian society won.
Yes.
But where are we now?
Right, it's an admonition against agrarianism, but try to tell that to us.
No, it's not. Agrarianism worked.
Oh no, that's actually a larger debate, perhaps for another time. Agrarianism may be the biggest fuck up humanity ever came up with.
Sedentary
agricultural society.
We had to be hunters.
But we'll do that some other evening. But it's clear in that story that, you know, Cain picks up the rock, bashes Abel's brains in, and motive is all over the place. And so, you know, when we're talking about why so let's say this kid was a racist incel. All right, he's motivated by that. But we still aren't any closer to the answering the question of, okay, you're pissed off, but why when white young male white wingers go get angry, why do they default to murder?
We don't know.
And one of the things that the NRA has been very good at is making sure that the medical community does not study that.
Right. They can't look at it. And that's been the big thing for the last 20 years. They are not allowed to look at gun violence as a trend. It's been 20 years. that they
well,
were
do you remember when the NRA
not to look?
Yeah, do you remember when the NRA had a shit hemorrhage because the American Pediatric or the American Association of Pediatrics
right.
or whatever were asking, are there any guns in the house as a means of assessing the safety and well-being
and
of children? Quit it.
You were not allowed to look there.
Right. Quit it.
Quit. Go away. That was 20 years ago.
And it hasn't gotten any better.
And the gun violence has been the same. And we're not allowed to say, oh, wow, should we look at the gun violence in the home as a cause.
Just like racism has to be taught. I mean, it does. No, nobody's.
There we go. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to laugh.
But
that's it. You've got to be carefully taught.
Yeah, racism has to be taught, and these attitudes toward guns have to be taught.
My brother is a. My brother is a redneck right wing, and he believes that I am the evil empire. I am not allowed to speak to his children
because you might tell them that guns are bad.
Yes. I might tell them that, oh, geez, you were brought up in Christian schools. You probably don't have a good view on the world. And he won't let me talk to his children. His children won't even talk to him.
Well, consider, I mean, I've got three grandkids. They range from 9 to 12.
I've got three from, let's see, 8 to 13.
And yours and mine have been through something that we never went through. Now, I grew up in the tornado belt. And long about March of every year, we would have our, well, probably February in elementary school, we'd have our tornado drills. Just to make sure that we remembered what to do in case of a tornado, because some parts of the building are safer than others, you know, when some 500-mile-an-hour nightmare comes over. And so we did our tornado drills. We were at the tail end of the Cold War. Well, I mean, you know, 70s, middle of the Cold War. And so we also knew what the... And they put up a siren not far away. And there was one kind of siren for tornado, and there was another kind of siren for commies.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew what to do in the case, and we practiced for the tornadoes a lot more than we practiced for the commies, because we had a nuclear reactor 18 miles away, and I think the grown-ups just sort of made an assumption that we really weren't going to have to worry about getting under the desk and kissing our asses goodbye.
Because you're going to be dead.
Yeah, it's just going to be a flash and done. Once they hit the nuke plant. But with tornadoes, you know, we were meticulous about it, and we knew what to do, where to go, how to try to keep ourselves safe, get away from glass, things like that. Well, my grandchildren they live in West Virginia for starters. So not a lot of tornadoes. No nuclear drills. Instead, they have active shooter drills. From kindergarten, beginning in kindergarten, they have drills for what to do when the angry white boy brings the gun to school.
Do they have the bulletproof backpacks?
Bulletproof backpacks, bulletproof sleeping mats. Most of these kids don't have those kinds of things. Instead, it's about being quiet and hiding and trying not to be noticeable, and locking doors, and not letting people in.
Get in the closet.
And getting in closets, and hiding in cubby holes. And that can't help.
I haven't had to deal with that.
That cannot.
That was my Sandy Hook
Yeah, that can't help but that can't help but impose a traumatic burden on the developing brain, and it's different from dealing with the weather. So, I mean, we've had these
tornadoes. We have active shooter.
Yeah, I mean, we had these studies, for instance, about
it just happened.
Yeah, the kids, the children in cages on the border. And the doctors have not been shy about talking about the negative impacts of that and what it will do to them for the rest of their lives and what it does to their relationship with their parents and their relationships with authority.
Parents.
Right. Well, there's you know, a generation of traumatized children becomes a generation of traumatized adults. And traumatized adults who are untreated and unassessed, well, they make bad decisions. And this isn't, you know, this isn't some sort of value judgment. It's a fact.
They go out and shoot people.
And sometimes they shoot people. Or sometimes, one of the things that traumatized people do more than anything else is self-medicate.
There's a lot of really good drugs out there.
Yeah, and so self-medication, God only knows what will be out there 20 years from now. But even now, self-medication through opioids, self-medication through crack, self-medication through meth, self-medication through booze, and yes, self-medication through weed.
It doesn't matter.
But when you're self-medicating, you cannot, by definition, get the dosage right. And so that means you are constantly in a feedback loop of screwing up and trying to unscrew and then screwing up again. And meanwhile, the pain and the hurt that causes it all is never addressed, especially in a country that still stigmatizes mental illness, and especially in a country where we don't give a fuck if anybody can go to the doctor when they're sick, physically or mentally.
See, Bob, I am one step above you. I can go to the doctor. I am, because of my kidney failure, I am a Medicare and Medicaid patient. It doesn't cost me anything. I can go and I say, this hurts, and they take me in. And I'm sorry. I hate to, you know, and I know you can't. And it hurts me that you can't. But I can. And I love it.
I'd like to be able to do that, but you know, just.
But no, because kidney failure, apparently is a trigger, and it's like it put me on. I'm on Medicaid.
Right, because you're basically on dialysis up to and including the day that you can get a kidney transplant, right?
Right. Or I die. That's where I go.
Well, I was kind of trying to avoid that, Scott.
But
we get it. We get enough Bob Kincaid, little ray of sunshine as it is, you know?
But, you know, my kidney, it's like, I'm fine. They're going to try and find me a kidney transplant. I've been 2 years now. They still don't even have a clue. I'm still on full Medicare.
Thank goodness you are.
And that's what it is.
Right. But meanwhile, you are, because of your status, but Florida still hasn't accepted the Medicare expansion, so that means that the working poor in Florida are screwed.
Right. But because I'm on the kidney thing, I'm covered. The rest of Florida, I don't know. I'd like to help them, but I'm still covered.
Yeah. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation, Scott. It's great to hear from you, man.
Okay, it's like nice calling in. I wanted to call in. I wanted to say hi to everybody because I've been gone for a long time. So I just, you know, if you let me go, I can go away.
Oh, but, you don't have to go away. But I mean, I just wanted to make sure that. You know, you're welcome here any old time you want to.
I've been trying to get in, but I couldn't. Man, there were many nights that I couldn't. I hurt. I couldn't get in because my body hurt. But I'm feeling better. So.
Well, I'm stoked for the report on the on the report with the kayak and the wetsuit.
I've got the kayak in the garage, and I bought the wetsuit, and I've got a thing to, so I can put the kayak on the top of my car, so I can carry it somewhere, and so I haven't done it yet. It'll be sometime in the next week.
Well, I've got a friend who got a fishing kayak up in, coastal Massachusetts, and he's been out a few times in it, chasing the big stripers just off the shore.
No, I'm looking for manatees and alligators.
I'm still saying you need to start with the manatees.
Yeah, but they're in the same place.
You just can't get through to some people. you had a note from David in South Carolina stand a little bit ago, Scott. Subject line: Burmese pythons, Florida. Don't forget the pythons, Scott.
No, they're not there. They're not up here. I've got gators. I've got manatees. I'm looking for the manatees. They're friendly.
Oh, they're beautiful. They're absolutely lovely creatures.
They come up and nudge. When you float up on the kayak, they come up and boom, nudge you as if they were, you know, you're a friend.
Yeah. And for their trouble over the last 50 years or so, they've gotten chewed to pieces by.
That's it, by the motorboaters going by.
Right, and with prop scars and stuff.
That's it, and you see them with the. You see with the scars down the back of their... It's like, oh, damn, that gotta hurt.
See, that comes from years and years and years of listening to Jimmy Buffett and hearing him sing, "Sometimes I see me as an old manatee going south as the waters grow colder, trying to steer clear of the humdrum so near, it cuts prop scars deep in my shoulder."
That's it, dude. I'm sorry. I live here. And I don't want to see manatees cut.
No, not at all. Not at all.
And I don't want to see, and I've got a really big problem. They're burying the reef here in the eastern beach of Melbourne County.
Damn.
They're burying it.
They haven't figured out that thing's there for a reason, have they?
Right. It's the first beach.
Well, like, you know, right.
First reef.
And like all the barrier islands that extend all the way from Texas, all the way around Florida, all the way up the Florida Atlantic coast, South Carolina, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, all the way up into Maryland and Delaware, those broad beaches were not put there to support boardwalks. They were put there by geologic processes that allowed them to protect the mainland from, you know, storm surges.
Getting killed.
Right.
I'm fighting. They are trying to bury our mid-reach reef here on the beaches of Florida. It's not good.
No, and I'm sure there's some plan to develop it somehow or another.
Oh, no, they want to put the hotels.
Yeah, sure.
Because if they bury the beach, oh, they've got 200 more feet of waterfront.
Sure, and in 100 years, it'll all be underwater, if not sooner.
But if we do it naturally, let's let nature do it. And no.
The problem there, Scott, is if nature does it, Nature's gonna wipe out a whole lot of those pesky little two-legged creatures running all over the state.
All those 100-story hotels, bang, gone. And you're not gonna let that happen.
I mean, I remember years and years ago when Jay Cruzan would call in, and it wasn't a hurricane or a big storm or anything. It was just rain in South Florida and Miami floods.
Yep. Right now, Miami floods on every high tide.
Yeah, that's what that was what shocked me when he would, because Jay Cruzan was working for the power company. FPL, and
yep.
And yeah, it wasn't even rain; it was just high tide.
High tide. Miami floods. They're 3 feet above normal. Every high tide. So the patrons sitting on the patio at the hotel have to move because they're in water.
By the way, if you've been following it after the hurricanes and stuff, how are the Keys doing?
The Keys don't exist.
Oh, that hurts.
The Keys don't exist. They're gone. They're still there, but there is no fight to keep them above water because it's not going to happen. You can't do it. What are you going to do? Put a barrier up above? Taking a flood. In 5 years, 4 years, taking a flood.
Exactly.
And what are you going to do about it?
Apparently, pass another law forbidding discussion of sea level rise in Florida.
Yeah, we can't. We can't talk about that. Thank you. We're not allowed to talk about it. Oh, that's illegal. And we're going to. I'm 30 feet above sea level where I live. In 10 years, I'm going to be underwater. What do I do?
I got nothing.
What do I do?
Yeah, you go and
in ten years, I have to move.
If not before then.
Well, I will move before, but if it keeps going in the direction it's going, I have to move.
And a whole lot of people are going to be moving with you.
I have an 84-year-old mother that lives here. How do I move her?
I don't even want to. My God.
She doesn't believe this. She says, "Well, what are you talking about?" I said, "Mom, the ocean is going to be on our." No, that's beyond comprehension. That's
Wow.
So I've got 5 years to move my mother.
I would not want to be. I would not want to be in. No.
No.
Because
no,
that. Because.
I don't
because
be
that's.
Here.
The, yeah, that was the. That's the big question I've been asking for years. You know, we see what's going on, and again, this is part of being so far out in front of the curve. We see what's going on at the southern border, and those are results of mass migration pressures that are not primarily climate change induced.
Right.
These are population pressures that are created by things like American foreign policy and our stupid war on drugs and our stupid drug prohibitions.
And we're an idiot.
But we are seeing how poorly the United States handles massive population shifts, massive migratory movements. And
because
here's the,
of and, climate change.
And here's, you know, here's one of the essential problems. When climate-driven mass migration happens, people in other states are not going to be any nicer about it than they're being to people from south of the border now. Okay? There are ugly stories out of every hurricane of gouging for hotel rooms and things like that, and people being robbed and what have you.
All the haters.
When it's a mass migration out of coastal America toward the interior, people in the interior are not going to be nice. I don't care how many Baptist soup kitchens the Southern Baptists put up, and I don't care how many. I don't care how much the Red Cross is involved. People who live away from that out migration are going to be pissed off and scared by the sudden appearance of millions of Americans, just like them, who have become refugees in their own country.
That is absolutely true, and it is not fun. I had to migrate once, and it was not fun.
No, it's.
I had to go to Georgia, and they did not want me. I had to move from Florida to Georgia for a weekend because we had a hurricane, and that was not a fun thing to do, and nobody there wanted me to be there. And when the massive tidal surge happens, I'm going to have to go to Georgia.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'll have to find Steve from Georgia and see if I can get comp rooms from him.
Yeah. Meanwhile, everything now is Airbnb.
But no, I can't go from when Florida goes underwater. Where am I going to go?
Well, yeah, where are you going to go when a few million people are going in the same direction?
That's it. And when you get on the highway and you're trying to get out of the state and you can't go anywhere, the traffic is stopped. And you're going to just sit there on the highway and get hit by a hurricane in your car.
Yeah, no kidding.
It happens.
Oh, it does. It does. All right, Scott. Well, I'm going to wrap things up for this evening. Man, it's been great to hear from you. Do holler back anytime that you feel the urge.
Well, thank you. It was a good time to talk to you.
I always enjoy it. You take care now, you hear? And again, photos from the manatee expedition and no gators, okay?
Show you, Gator.
All right. Later, man.
Bye.
Bye. That's our good buddy Scott from Florida. You'll know him as VT Blom. in the chat room. Great conversation. I love them. I love conversations that can range far and wide across a variety of topics. And that was a classic example. A few things, like I said, not much time left in the program this evening, but a few things to catch up on, worth the mention. Since we spent a lot of time talking about climate here in the last hour or so, well, there's been a little bit more movement in the effort to see Democratic candidates discuss climate. Of course, the DNC still forbids... Goddamn DNC, fucking Debbie Wasserman Schultz. No, she's not even there anymore. Never mind, shut up. The DNC still forbids it to be referred to as a debate. I'm trying to sort out why, but we'll just kind of leave that where it is. Well, CNN and MSNBC have announced that they're going to host climate fora in September. Each of them will host one. I imagine ads will be north of $100,000 a minute or more. And that's probably the motivation for CNN and MSNBC, is it's because we're talking about the multimillionaire for-profit media. It's an opportunity to make money and, you know, sell ads. But given the desires of the Democratic base to see a discussion of the topic, it's good news. The question is, will it be used as an excuse to continue to not put sufficient energies into the climate crisis in the debates themselves? But on September 4th, CNN's going to hold a climate forum in New York City. They're using the DNC, unfortunately, though, they're using the DNC's debate threshold for inclusion, even though it's not a debate. As of right now, the people on the stage for that would be Bernie, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Joe Biden, and Pete Buttigieg. You'll notice that absent from that list is the one candidate who has said that climate crisis is the central issue of his campaign. Absent from the list is that selfsame person who actually has experience running a progressive-oriented state government and experience in the Congress. I'm talking about Jay Inslee. That's a goddamn shame. Well, maybe he'll have a chance to get on the stage with MSNBC. They're partnering with Georgetown University's Climate Forum and a website called Our Daily Planet, based in D.C. It will happen September 19th to the 20th, and according to Georgetown, all declared 2020 presidential candidates from both political parties have been invited. So that means, theoretically, William Weld of Massachusetts, who has mounted some sort of a challenge to Donald Trump in the primary, is invited. The nitwit Nero himself is invited. People who have no business being in the presidential campaign, like Tom Steyer, are invited. Jay Inslee's invited. But, again, the problem with that is that it becomes almost impossible to get the message across. Nonetheless, Mo Elathy, head of the Georgetown Institute of Politics and Public Service, said, "Poll after poll shows climate change consistently rates as one of the most important issues on the minds of young voters heading into the 2020 election. League of Conservation voters, Tiernan Sittenfeld, said we look forward to hearing candidates discuss ambitious plans to act on climate on day one and every day of their presidency." The Sunrise Movement is not quite so sanguine. This is a youth organization oriented toward direct action, who said, well, our pressure's working, but these are not climate debates. We know that only a DNC-sponsored debate with all the candidates on the same stage at the same time will put the eyes of the nation on this crisis at the scale it demands. And you know what? They're correct. But there will be something. Last week, Thursday, Tom Steyer and Kirsten Gillibrand unveiled their plans for tackling climate change. I haven't read Gillibrand's yet, so I don't know if it involves keeping a loaded rifle or two under the bed. Incidentally, and interestingly, the scheduled date for the MSNBC event runs alongside a week-long global climate strike being called in 150 countries. Will there be much here? I don't know. Couple of other things, because it's More In Monday, we have More Ins. Here's a More In. Oh, this is a big More In. We find ourselves in Michigan, where the reigning Miss Michigan has been de-Miss Michiganized. Kathy Zhu, Z-H-U, was decrowned, unsashed. I don't know what the right term is, but she's not Miss Michigan anymore. She's not Miss Michigan because she turned out to be a nasty little racist and xenophobe, which is kind of odd for somebody whose last name is Z-H-U. It came to light that back in February of 2018, when she was in college, I guess she still is, she said, there's a try a hijab booth on, there's a try a hijab on booth at my college campus. So you're telling me that it's now just a fashion accessory and not a religious thing? Or are you just trying to get women used to being oppressed under Islam? And then, of course, because, of course, she had to, she tweeted, did you know that the majority of black deaths are caused by other blacks? Fix problems within your own community first before blaming others. In other words, don't complain when the cops blow you away or choke you to death. No. Take care of problems in your own community first. When she got called out on her bullshit, she said, that wasn't insensitive of me. It was statistical. And as for the hijab tweet or quote or quip, well, she said she was being decrowned because she refused to try on a hijab. Look. And maybe I get some shit for this. I, you know, but I don't think there's anybody listening to this program who doesn't know that I am generally hostile toward ideas of religion, but supportive of the idea of the freedom to follow one, if that's what gets you through the night. Hijabs are cultural holdovers of a culture and a society that developed in a hot, windy, dusty desert climate. The same can be said of the Spanish and the Italian mantilla, the lace curtains that women had to wear so that Jesus wouldn't lightning bolt them in church. They arise first as a human response to environmental conditions, just as things that are blousy and flow in a hot weather climate are more comfortable than, say, the tights and leggings of medieval and Renaissance England and France and Northern Europe, where those things, too, served a purpose. I get kind of sad when I see women wearing hijabs, but that's on me. I get kind of sad when I see Pastafarians walking around with colanders on their head, because it's something they have to do to keep their imaginary friend from being mad at them, whether it be a flying spaghetti monster or a Bronze Age mono deity. That head covering business is not limited to Islam. It can be found in Judaism, and it can be found, as noted, in Christianity, all of whom bear a relationship to the Bronze Age mono deity that has a hang up about shrimp and pork and you know, barbecued pork pig sandwiches. I'm generally disdainful of any faith system that tells you you have to dress a certain way in order for the deity not to murder you someday, out of an abiding sense of love and compassion, of course. So Miss Michigan can piss right up a rope as far as I'm concerned. The hijab booth was about normalizing cultural conduct that does no harm to anyone else. It was not about trying to get women used to being oppressed under Islam, because Islam cannot force any woman to wear the headgear who isn't Muslim. And some Muslim women wear the headgear and some Muslim women don't. Some Muslim women have to wear beekeeper suits, or things approximating them. Again, so their God won't kill them out of an abundance of love and compassion and mercy. I guess the larger question is, why didn't the Miss Michigan people vet her on the front end? But that's okay. She's landed on her feet, Miss Zhu. Because now, instead of being Miss Michigan of Miss World America, she's now a member of the Women for Trump Coalition Advisory Board. Yes. After she had displayed her bigotry, it became clear to the Trump campaign that she was a perfect fit for a campaign that is going to be based in hate and fear. Because now she can go around the country, or hell, around Michigan. Winning Michigan again is central to Nitwit Nero's ambitions. And saying that she was stripped of her title because they were prejudiced against her views because she had a different opinion. Because this is all part of the pogo sticking up onto the cross that the entire campaign is founded on. A constant litany of grievances over people not acceding to their bigotry. You can file this under the general heading of the racists are the ones who won't let us say that word. Yeah, I know. Ron in Raleigh says, funny, cover one head, uncover the other one. You know that of which, to which he refers. We may have some carryover Morans for tomorrow, but that's just fine. Assuming we don't get absolutely swamped in Titanic intellect between now and, say, 21 hours from now. One last thing on the way out the door. You remember a couple of months ago when a North Carolina member of the House of Representatives named Mark Meadows got busted when a video emerged from his prior campaign in which he was found to be shrieking to the faithful about Barack Obama being a Kenyan Muslim socialist usurper? And people pointed out that that was a pretty racist fucking thing for Mark Meadows to say. Do you recall the decency of Elijah Cummings in immediately running to his defense and saying, I know Mark Meadows, Mark Meadows is a friend of mine, and Mark Meadows is no racist? Do you recall that? Well, apparently, it's not a two-way street. Or if it is, it's a two-way street that gets blocked for 3 days. Nitwit Nero engaged in his racist attack on Elijah Cummings, and it raged on for 3 days before Mark Meadows could be bothered to come to the defense of the man he referred to as his best friend. Well, today he finally ended his silence. 3 days of sitting there watching his best friend be smeared. He finally spoke up. He had to be dragged to it. He had to be dog-walked to it. But Mark Meadows finally said today, via a text to none other than Bro-Fro-Mix Rick Sanctum Santorum, not to the world at large, not to Elijah Cummings, and God knows not in a tweet at Real Donald Trump, Mark Meadows finally said, no one works harder for his district than Elijah. Really? By the first name? How about Representative Cummings, or how about Chairman Cummings? He's passionate about the people he represents, and no, Elijah is not a racist. Well, duh. But then, because, well, it comes with the turf when you're a fucking lick spittle, he had to both-sider it. I'm friends with both men, President Trump and Chairman Cummins, and I know them both well, and neither is a racist. Well, it's philosophically impossible, culturally impossible, for Elijah Cummings to be a racist. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is a racist. Hashtag Donald Trump is a white supremacist. Because he couldn't just come out and defend the man who came out and defended him with no strings attached. He has to make sure that he doesn't somehow upset the tangerine Tiberius. On the way out the door, a note from Lady B. My grandfather was born in 1918 in Mississippi to a sharecropper. My father was born in 1935. All three had to fish, farm, and hunt just to eat. Although I do remember my father going hunting when I was a little girl, by the 1980s he was more into fishing. Said he had an old empty shotgun he kept in the living room closet. We kids, mostly girls except for our two half-brothers, were told to never touch that gun, and we didn't. In fact, I don't even remember my brothers even owning a gun as adults, and if they did, we never knew it. Yeah, it seems sexist to some, but it didn't matter. He said, don't touch it. We didn't, and that was that. My father was 6'6 and did two tours of duty in Vietnam. He worked as an engineer, but also did combat duty. He retired after 20 years as an E-7 with a Bronze Star and a sharpshooter distinction. Yet he only owned one shotgun. He died in 2013. My older sister told me she only remembers our granddaddy owning two guns, a pistol and a shotgun. He supported 11 children off that. Imagine. My father didn't talk about the war, and he didn't talk about guns. He knew how to use them, had fought with them, and possibly killed with them, but they were never a big part of his life. He was a big guy. He could defend himself, but he was never a mean person. People really enjoyed my dad. He was friendly, kind, and generous. I think he hated violence. But he was no wimp and no fool. He drank to forget the war. He was a happy drunk and harmless, but it wasn't a good habit. He also smoked, which along with multiple myeloma weakened his heart so much that it killed him. My dad was a man. There was never a doubt. And if anyone could have taken comfort in owning several guns, it should have been him. But he didn't. He didn't need to. He wasn't that scared. He had nothing to prove. A man will be a man the best way he can. I have no idea what a father really teaches his sons, but a smart man knows you'll never win every battle you fight, and some battles aren't worth fighting. So you pick your battles. Some things are beyond your control. You raise your kids with the Alcoholics Anonymous motto to accept the things they cannot change, change the things they can, and have the wisdom to know the difference. Hashtag not every multiple gun owner. I get that, but it makes you wonder, why do you need so many guns? Two guns, Bob. A Mississippi farmer two generations away from slavery with the Klan in full force, and he only needed two guns to help feed his family. It's not the guns, Bob. It's the people. Future generations will call us savages. We will be case studies on the dysfunctional behavior of some, and the Stockholm Syndrome-like acceptance of those in denial. We will be pitied. And if we're lucky, our ways will be forgotten. Then, who would be considered a real man? One of these days, I may get an opportunity to sit down with Lady B. I don't know. I have a feeling it would be a, it would be one of those long form conversations where we just kind of have to go back and forth when the other takes a breath. The only gun my father ever owned was the one that put a bullet through his elder son's brains. It wasn't my brother's. He tried to tell the cops it wasn't my brother's, but the family that probably owned it wanted nothing to do with it, and the cops insisted it was, and they sent it home with us. In second grade, feeling terribly grown up, I had thought I wanted a briefcase, and they bought me one, Samsonite, hard-sided. But it wouldn't even hold all the books that a second grader carried home from school. That was back when we carried books home from school. And it would be full near to bursting, and I'd have a hard time closing it, and then it was heavy as hell for a second grader. It was easier to put it in an old military, put my books in an old military knapsack from the Army surplus, so I'd have both straps on my back carrying my books home. And so when that gun came home, it got put in that briefcase and tucked into the furthest, deepest corner of my parents' bedroom closet with my brother's dried blood still on it. It was that way when my father died and I found it again, and we took it out to a landfill and threw it as far as we could into it, hoping a bulldozer would cover it in short order. It was a Ruger semi-automatic .22. It was capable of being fired with the clip out and around in the chamber, and that was exactly what happened. It was loaded with a .22 caliber round that had rat shot in it. To this day, I remember the cop saying, "And the rat shot peppered his brain." I don't know why he felt the need to speak in such graphic terms to a pair of grieving parents, but he did. Sergeant Nykirk of the Atlanta Police Department. My father didn't fish. My father didn't hunt. My father didn't like to kill things. He had seen human beings on fire aboard an aircraft carrier, and that was enough death for him. His father, my grandfather, ran counter to the West Virginia narrative, too. He neither hunted nor fished. My father didn't fish because he couldn't stand the idea of hurting the fish. He said, even if you throw it back, how would you like to have a hook run through your jaw? It had an impact on me. In the modern era in which we live, where people get everything and everything they can, you can imagine pierced, and some things you can't, I don't know if it would have the same impact. On the other hand, on the other side of my family, as I've mentioned before, we have the ledgers of mountaineers coming in and buying yards of gingham and yards of muslin and cheesecloth, of sugar and lard and flour. And in the mix there are shotgun shells. There's almost always shotgun shells. Because, well, it wasn't Sergeant York, and nobody was licking the end of the rifle. And shotguns are much more effective on things like squirrels. And even deer within 100 yards, and God knows turkeys. And you could make more use out of them. So I get what Lady B says. In the future, and in all futures look back on all pasts as being to one degree or another barbarian, savage. And we, too, will be barbarians and savages. And that's okay. As long as maybe in the future, they're a little less so. So thanks, everybody. Thanks for joining in for this Morin Monday. Thank you to all of you, all the subscribers, both PayPal and Patreon and via the U.S. mails, who keep this program going. Thank you to everybody who kicks in ad hoc during the week and the month for the other three quarters of the funding that keeps this program going. And extra special thanks this month for not just 5, but 6 days of fundraising free radio where we can take a breath, step back from the need to keep the bills paid, and just go about this as though no money is required whatsoever. Thank you. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks earlier in the evening to Steve from Georgia Stan in the chat room. Thank you to Sparky in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you to Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Thanks to John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20 years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. It's worth checking them out. Like them on Facebook. Get their notices. Follow them on Twitter, @ColRiverMTN. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.